The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Experience lightning fast speeds and Sky's best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Now, I have a lovely book in front of me, and if you've ever had a reason to visit Dubai or even fly through it and you're kind of fascinated by it, or you've worked there or you've gone there just for holidays, you might well be interested in Diving for Pearls. It's the first novel by Jamie O'Connell. It's a glittering story of a magical city in the desert and the various strata of the society that inhabit it. There's a cast, of course, of red-haired Irish people trying to make a living over there, along with the locals, Ethiopian people, and even movie stars showing up in the pages. And Jamie O'Connell is live and in studio with us.
I'm thrilled to be in studio. Thank you.
It's great. It's great to see other humans and not worrying about lines going down and everything like that. I mean, when you talk about movie stars, we see very early on this movie star who has very shiny teeth. And he climbs the Burj.
Yes.
Like we recognize, we know this film.
Yes. So
but you don't mention it.
I suppose because it is heavily influenced by someone who was there, but I suppose I can only, it's my interpretation of that. It's fiction. I haven't spoken to him directly about his experience or anything like that. But that came about because when I was first visited Dubai in 2010, I suppose what kind of set the whole thing off was flying into Dubai and you're just kind of coming in over the Persian Gulf, this glittering blue sea, and then the plane swerved around over this kind of sandy desert, and there's just this city sitting there in the middle of the desert. And it's not like a Dublin city, like two or three story buildings. We're talking like 70, 80 story skyscrapers of glass and steel. And afterwards, when I thought about it, I was like, what impression did it leave on me? And actually it was like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she sees the Emerald City for the first time, that kind of like dazzling city. So for a time, I knew I had to write about it because my background is short stories, but I just couldn't find the story, my way into the city, I suppose. And it was actually reading Colin McCann's book, which was out at the time, Let the Great World Spin, which is his novel set around 1970s New York. And it's a portrait of a city at the time. And I just loved, like, the 70s New York was amazing. It was, you know, Halston, which was on TV recently,
yes,
and sort of Studio 54. It just was a moment in the city that's very special. And for me, I was able to kind of go, well, this was a moment in Dubai when this film star arrived. And I kind of took the inspiration from how he then structured his novel to give a portrait of a city and use that sort of similar structure, these multiple viewpoints then to create Dubai as it appears in the novel.
So it's 2010 in the novel.
2010, November.
We know from recent reading of the years, this was a pretty grim time in Ireland. People were obviously escaping a recession here, and then you're arriving in this glinting, like it glints with wealth, doesn't it?
Yes,
Dubai. So were you there yourself in that period?
I was, between kind of 2010 and over the next few years. Like, I'm that late millennial age who all kind of graduated at the exact wrong moment. And many of my friends, probably two-thirds of my friends, left Ireland at that time to look. There was nothing going on here. Even myself, I really struggled for a couple of years to kind of find my feet. And Dubai, as much as, you know, we've all seen the news, there's definitely challenges and things as Westerners we find maybe not that, you know, we'd be comfortable about. But it offered refuge to my friends at that time. It was this kind of oasis in the desert. And as much as this book has, like, when things go wrong in Dubai, I also have this other viewpoint that it did give opportunity to people who really needed opportunity. And also, the whole world was in a conversation of negativity. And to land in Dubai, and people are optimistic. They're like, I'm going to make something of my, like, I will work hard and things will go right. You know, that kind of optimism.
Yeah, and I
think that's such a powerful thing. So I hope the book has a nuance to it, that it's not like Dubai is an awful place, because it isn't. There's a lot about the place that I actually think is great. And I love the optimism. I love the fact that, like, we'll build a skyscraper and it appears, you know, it's kind of, they're very passionate, you know, and, but at the same time, going there as a Westerner and as an Irish person, I think actually as well, thinking about our past and immigration and things like that and how we were maybe treated going elsewhere in the 19th century and early 20th century and, you know, kind of discriminated against, I did feel an unease when I landed there firstly landing and I went into my friend's villa there and I came with the Barry's tea. We had a cup of Barry's tea, long flight, all the rest of it. And my case had gone upstairs to the room. And then I came upstairs and my clothes were put away. They were all ironed. It was done. Like a maid had done it. And I was like, I'm not sure about this. Like, I really feel uncomfortable.
And this is very typical everywhere, isn't it?
Very, very typical.
Yeah. And the Dubai maids.
But one thing I realized about myself, which made me kind of think about how we approach luxury. And rather than sitting here in Ireland finger wagging about what other people do, is 2 weeks later after I left Dubai and I landed back in Ireland, and my case was full of all Maldiel clothes, and I opened my case, like, God, I'd love the maid. Okay. So I was like, how quickly we are corrupted by luxury, you know? So,
but we have the Irish guilt thing, don't we?
Yes.
Certainly, like, taxi drivers put luggage into the boot.
Yeah.
There's a great scene because Siobhan, who's one of the young Irish mammy who's living in Dubai,
yeah.
Tell us about the Christmas brunch.
Well, the brunch is the closest thing I can say to that is if you did like the Roman feast in school, you know, the vomitorium and all that, you know, so you just keep eating and eating. So you pay to go into a hotel. It's the Friday brunch. Friday is like the Saturday there. They have a different weekend. And you go in and you pay, I think it's about €200. It's not cheap, but and then you go in and what you have is what they call them kitchens. So you go into this huge hall of like buffet, but not buffet on steroids is the only way to describe it. So you have an English breakfast kitchen and it has, no, English dinner kitchen, sorry. So it'll have everything from Yorkshire puddings through to chicken to beef to thing, everything. You go to the next kitchen, the cheese kitchen, and it will have every kind of cheese. And I mean, cheese that you probably only find in Dingle, you know, that kind of like the, you know, the real cottage cheese. Like, where, how are they even getting this in here?
Yes.
And then you go into the next kitchen, the seafood kitchen, and then you go into the next kitchen, the Thai food kitchen, and then you go into the next kitchen, it's the Indian food kitchen. And you kind of buy time there, 6 or 7 hours from like lunchtime till early evening. And you're assigned a table and you can go up and down and pick on whatever you like. Typical Irish people, like, you know, don't eat the bread now. Get the lobster.
Yeah.
You know, and at the same time, you're kind of going, how am I like really feeling the booze? Because I've only had this one glass and it's halfway down. And then you realize there's almost people hidden and they're just topping you up the whole time, your champagne glass. And so you have no idea when you leave. You're nearly rolled out of the place.
I nearly needed a Gaviscon just reading about it. Like the book, what is the book essentially about? Because we start with a body floating.
Yes.
But then there's this Irish family who appears very quickly.
Yes.
So can you give us a flavor of what you were...
As I said, the issue with... Like when Dubai works, it all seems to work very smoothly. So I really found my way into, because my background is short stories. So plotting a novel is a different thing. It's a different kind of form. And it needs to be strong enough to hold for a whole 70 or 80,000 words. And that was probably the biggest challenge of the book for me. And funny enough, when I was in Dubai, something clicked. It was about my third visit. I was like, this is very similar to how Victorian London used to be. And what I mean by that is, London in the 19th century was like the center of innovation. It was cutting edge, but at the same time, very conservative, you know, mm-hmm. Victorian era. On top of that, this kind of complex relationship with morality, which on the surface is family values and all very clean. But then underneath it, this whole substrata of society of, you know, of sex workers and so on. And then the final thing was London was in the 19th century had this rich upper class and, you know, the class supporting them underneath. So these, it was
both
like
extremes.
It was like this fireworks went off in my head. And I was like, who's the great London writer? And it clicked, Charles Dickens. And out of that, my favourite Charles Dickens book is Our Mutual Friend.
Yeah.
And that book opens up with a body found in the Thames. And I went, I have the opening of my story. Now, there's no other comparison to the book, like storyline to that, other than the body found in the
Dickens
river.
Dickens didn't do the Christmas buffet, but if he did...
No. But that was how the novel started. I was like, okay, so there's a body in Dubai Marina. And then out of that, then I had a story. Because, I mean, I'm talking to you here about lots of themes and things like that.
Mm.
But I hope my reader just, if you're sitting in a hotel or on a beach somewhere, you can read this and be like, my dream for this book is someone falls in love with the characters I've written and really connects to them. And then they go through hell and back with the characters and are sitting on the edge of their seat, gripped as everything falls apart. You know, I want that rising tension through the book.
So tell us about those characters, because they are really familiar to us, and particularly of that era in the recession, because you've got the kind of the older, the matriarch at home watching her kids disappear with the recession, and then you've got the young ones trying to make it in this shiny paradise.
Yeah. Well, Joan, for me, highlights something that we don't talk about, I think, enough in terms of Irish immigration, be it 2010 or 1980, which is we can talk about the economic situation, but what about all these families that are split up? You know, the family who are now, and I sometimes wonder, you know, like we don't talk about it enough, you know, of people, even with the maids in Dubai. I think of, you know, we kind of go, God, they have all these maids in Dubai and that's not great. But I'm like, most people have maids because they don't have the aunties and the grannies and the, you know, around them to kind of support. And so if you're a couple out there and you've children and you don't have an aunt or a grandparent or something to mind your child, you're going to need a maid. That's a necessity to have a night off, you know.
Yeah.
So I think Joan, for me, reflects that Irish situation that's been going on since the 19th century of the person left behind. And then in terms of Siobhan and Trevor, for me, they are my generation
her
of
kids.
Irish.
Yeah,
her kids.
Grown-up kids.
Yes. And they are in Ireland. Trevor especially is in Ireland, and he's a personal trainer, but it's 2010. He's a kind of a minimum wage paying job. It's not going anywhere. And he feels like a total failure because he can't see any future in Ireland. At the same time, he has an uncle in Ireland who's Joan, his mother's brother, who didn't leave Ireland in the 80s when he could. And he's kind of this ghost haunting Trevor, kind of going like, if I stay, will I?
Yes.
You know, he has alcohol issues and things like that. So Trevor, and then Trevor goes to Dubai. And in a way, he's our eyes as the reader to kind of see Dubai from both its good and bad side, because he notices the maids and the taxi drivers,
yes,
and that. But he also notices, well, I could have opportunity here. And what do you do? Do you stay put in Ireland without opportunity, or do you go somewhere and connect to a society that you know has flaws and you're not entirely comfortable with? It's kind of an impossible choice, if you know what I mean. So,
yeah.
And then I suppose thinking of Siobhan and the other kind of main Irish character as his sister, she's living in Dubai and has lived there for a few years, and she loves a bit of glam. She does,
yeah.
Like she does, and
that's putting it
that.
Mildly.
Yeah,
she's big into it, isn't she?
And
you're almost saturated with brands and huge designer labels and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a rich, diverse cast of characters here, isn't there? And as you say, the maids and the taxi drivers are big characters in as well. But let's talk about Assam,
yes,
who we first meet in Dublin.
In Dublin, yes. So he's a gay Emirati. So he's kind of the reverse. He's actually you find out straight away in the book that he's essentially the brother of the girl who's died, and that brings him back to Dubai in the course of the book. And for me, I mean, I'm very careful when I think about, like, he's a gay man who's Muslim, and I don't want to speak for another culture's experience.
Yes.
However, I'm a gay man who grew up in a extremely conservative environment. You know, my parents are Jehovah's Witnesses, and I think the conflict that Asim and I would face is exactly the same, of where it's just not accepted. You know, it's just, I think when I grew up, the way I'll say it was this, is the first thing I noticed was being in a very conservative environment, there's the truthful answer and there's the right answer. So you end up in this relationship with your parents where you're giving them what they want to hear rather than how you actually feel.
Right.
And then that gradually, for me anyway, through my teens, which developed into a feeling of, I suppose I just didn't feel I was ever accepted by my parents fully, because I was gay, and it was this kind of constant approval seeking that then started to happen through school. And I just threw myself into school and was just trying to get better and better grades, because I think I was just waiting for that moment when everything would click. And Asim is the same as that. I think he's a smart guy. He's studying medicine in Dublin. He really wants to achieve something, but he has the wound that I think maybe a lot of gay people who maybe are in similar situations feel, which is they weren't quite the child their parent wanted, if you know what I mean. I don't know if that sounds...
Did you come out directly to your parents, or was it just sort of hovering?
I came out, actually, my parents, I was 19, and but I knew what it meant. I knew it was that was the end, essentially. That was the end of our relationship
In terms of contact?
Yeah.
That was obviously very difficult.
I
mean, a lot of
yes.
us who grew up, obviously, in Catholic households, I didn't
yeah.
come out until I was 31. So, you
okay.
know, I was just waiting for someone just to say,
okay.
you know, what the truth was, and that I could
yeah.
relax. But, like, it's never easy when it happens.
Mm.
When you're 19 and you suddenly find yourself alone, it wasn't easy.
Yeah, no, I would be honest. I definitely, around that sort of between maybe 17 and 24, firstly, I lived two lives for a while, which a lot of gay people do, even if it's not in such an extreme circumstance. And nothing will destroy your mental health like trying to live two lives. And, you know, for me, it would have been trying to sort of, because being in, I suppose, a Jehovah's Witnesses, you're part of a community, and you don't have huge contact with people outside of that community, really, when you're in it. So leaving the religion is leaving everything, leaving your friends, leaving your, it's a huge break. So I tried to, I suppose, have feet in both worlds for a while. And that was really, I mean, I was getting panic attacks and agoraphobia, and later kind of went through a period of depression, especially when I kind of came out the far side. But anyway, I suppose bring it back to the book, that
this is
energy,
how you relate to this.
That's how I, you know, and so Asim is both smart and he's going to get somewhere in life, but there's this broken element of him that means that he's quite destructive behavior. You know, he's
living
too much.
The two lives.
He was living the two lives, exactly.
In your own case, are those issues resolved now?
They're resolved in that I've made peace with them. They're not resolved. I think the most damaging thing.
You could take
Sorry.
Yeah, no, take your time. And I don't want to push you too much on this because it's a good day for you that you've got the book out and everything. So, you know, it's a joyous occasion. But you obviously had the relief initially when you got to come out. So you joined the world, essentially.
Yeah.
But you have some contact now, do you, with family?
Oh, I'm very close to other members. Like my siblings are incredible. And in fact, one of the things I loved most writing in the book was the relationship between Trevor and Siobhan, because that was just drawn straight from the loving relationship I would have with my siblings. I have two sisters and a brother who were all extremely tight.
Great.
My brother had a baby yesterday and him and his girlfriend. So shout out to that. so that I was able to bring the warmth of all that. And actually that's been the most healing thing of all, I'd say. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So it's those experiences obviously gave you that character. And I mean, he's living in that kind of difficult world, isn't he? Let's talk about Trevor, because we might recognise this character probably from sports stars who've talked about their mental health issues over recent years.
Yeah, I think Trevor is I think we've moved on in 10 years compared to the Trevor in the book. It's 2010. And I think what's been amazing in the last 10 years is so many sports stars have come out and talked about their, you know, and kind of normalised, you know, their mental health issues. But Trevor, there's so much more going on in his head than he ever says. You know, we don't realise the depth of, and I think, you know, we all know that, so, you know, we can all put on a smiling face going into work and we're not feeling that way, you know. So, but I think Siobhan sees him more clearly than anyone else. She, from young age, she, and there's a scene in the book, because the book only takes place over a week. That was really, I suppose, because I'm a short story writer, so that little tight time frame kind of suited me. But to kind of get the bigger picture, there's flashbacks to Siobhan kind of hunting off the bullies when he's younger and things like that. And she's constantly protective of him.
And he's got his own secrets.
He has his own secrets, yeah. So he has his own... I think when people have an element of maybe self-hatred or things they don't like about themselves, then that leads to kind of destructive behaviours, and that's what's kind of happened with him as well. He kind of almost needs the release of the built-up tension. So he makes, like in the book, he makes one or two choices that I certainly wouldn't be agreeable to. But I hope he's really, of anyone in the whole book, by the end of the book, I'm hoping he's the most changed. He's the person who's finally managed to get outside of his own perspective and see the world.
But we can recognise him because he's at a certain age. He's trying to get out of Ireland in 2010. He sees the promise of the riches of Dubai. But what's amazing is that he still has the draw home. Mm. And I mean your friends, that because he went over to Dubai.
Yeah.
And I think you said somewhere that you've got friends kind of scattered around the world.
Yeah.
And they're still there, aren't they, around the place? What kind of countries are they?
Amsterdam, Paris, London, America, Australia. Like, I feel half my generation hasn't come back.
And do you think they will at this stage?
I know. I think because some of them bought properties, some of them have children, they've married there. I think their lives are settled there. And the one good thing about nowadays is Ryanair flights and all that. It's very easy to kind of get back and forth. But I do think that's maybe a cost we don't think of when we're thinking about kind of the recession and people moving, is the social cost of family and friends being apart. And that's big.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, but then they set down roots and it becomes a second home.
Yeah.
You stayed in Ireland despite everything.
I did. I was very lucky because I worked in publishing actually for a few years afterwards, and I got a job in a publishing house in Dublin, and I feel I maybe got the last job in Ireland before there was any jobs in publishing for about 3 or 4 years. I do actually feel very lucky that just things lined up in such a way. But I don't know if that hadn't come up, what would have been my next move, you know? So I suppose we can't know how that would work out. And we're here today.
Yeah. So 51551 is the text. Hi, Jamie's an interesting young man. We should remember that we couldn't wait to do exactly the same thing with luxury during the Celtic Tiger times. There was certainly no guilt felt. We were very comfortable with it. Plenty of fancy cars, cleaners and so on. There's a good point there, isn't there? Embraced it.
Because I have a scene in Ireland where Joan actually goes to Rusborough House, quite deliberately so, because that's rich Irish people 60, 70 years ago, and they were well able to spend the cash. Yes. Do you know what I mean? So I deliberately put that in because I was like, anything where I made a comment maybe about Dubai, I really tried to show something back in Ireland. Because I mean, a personal belief of mine is that there's a quote by that Roman playwright who says, I'm a human being, nothing human is alien to me. So to never, to be aware that anything a human can do is within you. So I hope, I don't want to finger wag in this book. I just want to show it how it is. And hopefully, I'd rather people went away with kind of a sense of humanity and common humanity rather than a sense of, oh, Dubai is...
And you're not totally knocking. Hi, Oliver. My niece is teaching in Dubai for the past 5 years. Her Instagram photos depict a non-stop partying lifestyle with colleagues every weekend. It seems fabulous. I mean, you have portrayed that as well as what's kind of happening underneath.
Yeah.
And one of the most striking things actually was the dusty luxury cars in the airport that Trevor sees on his first visit. Tell us about those.
Certainly in the case in 2010 when the economic crash happened in Dubai, which is a case with many, I think with many of the Middle Eastern countries, you just can't go bankrupt. It's not, it's actually a criminal offence. So if things go wrong, you just leave. Because it's an offence that could land you in serious trouble. So and they're very strict on kind of making sure your checks don't bounce and things like that. That they're, it's a very strict culture that way. So at the time, definitely 2010, I don't know actually right now if that's still as strict as that, but definitely in 2010, the financial crash did hit Dubai, but they bounced back quite quickly from it. But when that financial crash hit, people left. And it is quite common seeing car parks there, cars with like... And you think, if I could just get them back to Ireland, I'd love that car. I'd love that Ferrari,
spooky.
But you know,
it's
but they're just sitting
though,
there with an inch of dust on them, you know.
Yeah, so. I think it's just such a visceral image of, you know, the kind of problems. There's a lot of love coming in for you here, I have to say. Great interview. I love this young man, Jamie, says a Tipperary mammy. And being a Cork man, you'll accept Tipperary praise. Jamie speaks so well about the difficulty for young people and the family expectations. Best of luck to him with his wonderful new book, Cats. Well, it's all about family secrets and everything. One thing I want to ask you, as a fan of the book, is that you leave us wanting more with some of the characters. Mm. It's not a spoiler to say that, but you don't neatly wrap everything up for some characters.
Yes. The reason for that, and I don't know if you noticed, the prologue and the epilogue start with the same sentence.
I didn't notice that. Okay.
And the reason being, I just wanted this feeling of circular, that it's the new, the book ends with sort of the new, Irish people arriving or leaving, and it all starts all over again. So the book that, and it, life isn't neat. I didn't feel, it would be lying to the world I've created in this book to say, there's a bow at the end of it. You know, it's not that. But
out of kilter with the style.
Yes.
Well done. You are great to tell a story for so many. Being accepted for who you are, such a fundamental need for every human, and the bittersweet story that is emigration, says Neve. Good morning. Please repeat the name of your interviewee. Well, it's Jamie O'Connell and Diving for Pearls. We were never going to stop saying that. I'm a regular visitor to Dubai to my daughter and two grandchildren, says Pat Crowley, or it could be Crowley, depending on the part of the country he's from. And we'll end on this. What a fabulous young man being interviewed. He is wonderful in his honesty, even though his pain is clear. I'm looking forward to reading his book, says Fidelma. Well, your talent is clear as well, Jamie, and we wish you the best of luck. It's a great novel. Thank God I don't have to pretend. So thanks very much for that. So you've done, so be proud of that. What are you doing this afternoon?
So this evening I'm launching with the West Cork Literary Festival at 7 p.m. So I think it's an online thing. So
oh, great.
Where you are. So you can just go onto their website and get a ticket. I'm talking to Sophie White, who you may know from the podcast,
yes,
The Creep Dive.
Yes.
So I'm delighted because she well knows how to do a Zoom event. So very, I think good, it'll be good chats.
And when it's your first book, do you do a wee gander through the bookshops quietly and go, yeah, there's the book, there's my book?
Do you know, I was around the city yesterday and I have to say, I had a heart attack when I went to Grafton Street and it's in the window. I couldn't believe it.
Really?
It was like, because funny, like...
It's a pretty book. It's a pretty book. Jamie O'Connell, Diving for Pearls. Best of luck with it.
Cheers.
Good morning.
Thank you.